Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, the United States has announced plans to open much of the country's coastal waters to oil and gas drilling. The Interior Department released the 5-year plan last week. It is much more expansive than one suggested by President Donald Trump in April of last year. The Interior Department proposed to publicly sell 47 possible drilling rights in much of the U.S. continental shelf. That is a large increase from the 11 lease sales during the presidency of Barack Obama. The draft of the plan would permit the sale of drilling leases in 25 of 26 offshore planning areas. The one area identified as off-limits is the waters near Alaska's far western Aleutian Islands. The area was given special protection by former President George W. Bush. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke told reporters last week that the United States is, in his words, going to become the strongest energy superpower this world has ever known. Zinke also said that he wants to grow the country's offshore energy industry instead of having to depend on foreign energy resources. We will produce enough energy to meet our needs at home, and we will export enough energy to lead the world, he said. The Interior Department's broad proposal is meant to begin with a 60-day public comment period. The Interior Department is responsible for setting the start date of the comment period. Zinke said in a press release that not all areas are appropriate for offshore drilling, and we will take that into consideration in the coming weeks. Some critics of the plan have already expressed their feelings. The opponents include environmental groups and governors from coastal states. When the plan was first released, waters off Florida's coastline were included. However, Zinke announced on Tuesday that he is now banning oil and gas drilling off the Florida coast. In a statement, Zinke said, "I support the governor's position that Florida is unique and its coasts are heavily reliant on tourism as an economic driver." The Interior Secretary admitted that Florida Governor Rick Scott pressured him to amend his decision. The Defense Department has also expressed concerns about drilling in the eastern Gulf of Mexico, where the U.S. Navy performs exercises. The Trump administration is currently operating under a plan set up by the Obama administration. The plan is for the years 2017 to 2022. Obama has proposed drilling off the Atlantic coast and off Alaska's Arctic coast. However, both proposals were removed in the final version of the plan. Last year, Zinke took a number of steps to make it easier to lease and explore for oil on land and in water. He removed some safety laws that were put into place after the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010. The Deepwater Horizon rig caught fire after an oil well explosion. 11 people were killed. The resulting oil spill, nearly 5 billion barrels over 5 months, was the worst offshore oil spill in American history.
Each year, the Las Vegas Consumer Electronics Show, or CES, is the place to be for examples of the latest developments in technology. The show this year is no different. So we have put together a list of some of the most interesting new products from CES 2018. Some people might remember Sony Corporation's first AIBO robot. The mechanical dog was launched in 1999. It was considered revolutionary at the time, but the company eventually stopped producing it. But the AIBO robot was brought back for CES 2018. AIBO means companion in Japanese, and the newest robot dog is designed to be just that. Sony says AIBO can form emotional connections with individual family members and teach nurturing skills. It uses artificial intelligence, or AI, to react to touch and voice commands. AIBO communicates through body language, such as eye, ear, and tail movements, and voice sounds.
Of all the televisions demonstrated at CES 2018, one of the most unusual is a huge model that can roll up like a newspaper. LG Display made a 162-centimeter or 64-inch long model. It is powered by the same OLED technology used in TVs. The company explains the technology can let users hide the display or lower it to different heights to change picture size. Some major manufacturers also showed off TV models with new 8K technology, which nearly doubles the picture resolution of 4K. One of the companies is Samsung Group, which said its Q9S model uses AI to automatically bring lower quality video up to 8K. Samsung also launched a 371-centimeter or 146-inch micro LED receiver called the Wall.
Chinese automaker Byton presented a new electric sport utility vehicle, or SUV, that can also drive itself. The company says the smart vehicle uses facial recognition technology to open the doors. The car is controlled from a large computer screen. Sensors continuously measure the driver's heart rate and blood pressure. China's Forward X Robotics demonstrated a four-wheeled travel bag that automatically follows its user around the airport. The smart bag uses cameras and AI to avoid crashes. The device can message the owner if it gets too far away or when the battery power gets low. The FeeFish P3 by Kaisi is an underwater robot that can take photographs or send live video from depths of up to 100 meters. The camera, controlled by a device, captures 4K HD and uses powerful LED lighting.
Bellus 3D introduced a high-quality face scanning camera for mobile devices. The camera uses AI to create a 3D model of your face. The images can be shared or used to help a person find the right makeup products. Users can even create a realistic 3D face mask. At least two companies showed off smart underwear meant to improve the health of the person wearing it. Skin launched underclothing for men and women. These products can measure a person's heart rate, temperature, breathing, body fat, water intake, number of steps walked, and sleep history.
The Orcam MyEye 2.0 device is made for blind people or those with limited eyesight. It is a smart camera about the size of a finger. The device can read out writing or print from any source. It is also equipped with AI tools to recognize faces, products, and money in real time. Also at CES 2018, French airbag maker Helite demonstrated wearable hip protectors for older people. The battery-powered system is worn as a belt just above the hips. When an individual is about to fall, sensors cause the side airbags to fill with air to help prevent broken bones. Beauty products manufacturer L'Oréal released two new products at the show. Each is designed to help inform individuals of ultraviolet or UV sun exposure. UV Sense is a small wearable sensor that can be worn for up to 2 weeks on the end of a finger. The sensor links up with mobile devices to provide warnings about too much sun.
R-Per is a French company still raising money to increase production of its anti-pollution mask. The mask is designed for drivers of bicycles and motorcycles. The product is designed to keep out harmful pollutants in the air, as well as viruses and bacteria. The makers of the electron wheel say anyone can turn a traditional bicycle into an electric-assisted cycle in just 30 seconds. The company says the wheel, which replaces the front tire, has a powerful motor and can travel up to 80 kilometers. Several manufacturers have been demonstrating smart shower technology at CES. Users can control water flow and temperature from mobile devices, and in most cases also by voice, and can also play and sing along with music.
Kohler presented its Numi toilet, which it describes as the finest in personal comfort and cleansing. The device-connected machine includes programmable lights, plays music, and has a heated seat and foot warmer. Smart appliances seem to be the future of home kitchens. Several companies are launching fully programmable refrigerators that do a lot more than keep food cold. Samsung says its Family Hub creates shopping lists, orders food, and can see inside the refrigerator for you. It can connect with mobile devices to share information, play music, or even stream video from a Samsung TV elsewhere in the home. Finally, several smart toothbrushes were shown, including the Magic model from Colibri. The company says the product is the first in the world to use augmented reality to educate children on the best methods for cleaning teeth. It records user movements and shows the child, in a fun, interactive way, the best ways to brush. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. In 1823, President James Monroe introduced one of the most important foreign policy decisions in American history. It became known as the Monroe Doctrine. The doctrine said the United States never had and never would take part in any war between the European powers. At the same time, it warned the Europeans against interfering in the Western Hemisphere. Monroe declared that the Americas are not to be considered as subjects for future colonization by any European powers. Historian Harlow Giles Unger says the Monroe Doctrine marked the end of the colonial era.
The United States now considered the entire Western Hemisphere our sphere of influence, that we would keep out of their affairs, but they must keep out of our affairs.
The United States continued to grow. New states joined the Union. Indiana, Mississippi, Illinois, and Alabama all became states before 1820. Louisiana had earlier become the first state to be formed from part of the Louisiana Territory that the United States bought from France. The rest of this huge area was called the Missouri Territory. By 1819, there were enough people in part of the Missouri Territory for that part to become the state of Missouri. But becoming a state required the approval of Congress. And historian Harlow Giles Unger says admitting Missouri would have changed the balance of power in the Senate.
The Senate gave each state 2 votes. And by convention, since the signing of the Constitution, the Senate was evenly divided between slave states and non-slave states. So the admission of Missouri would have added a slave state to the Senate and left the northern non-slave states as a minority, and they were not going to accept this.
Slaves were not new in America. Spain had brought them to the West Indies hundreds of years before. In 1619, a ship brought 20 African slaves to Jamestown, Virginia. These black men were sold to farmers. Over the years, the use of slaves spread to all the American colonies. However, there were many more slaves in the agricultural South than in the North. The farms in the North were smaller and needed less labor. But in the South, farms were much larger. Slaves were the least expensive form of labor. Most of the northern states had passed laws before 1800 freeing slaves. Even the southern states made it illegal to import more slaves from Africa. But those southerners who already owned slaves believed they were necessary, and they refused to free them. Slavery had been legal when France and Spain controlled the Louisiana Territory. The United States did nothing to change this when it purchased the territory. So slavery was permitted in the Missouri Territory at the time Missouri asked for statehood. A New York congressman, James Talmadge, offered an amendment to Missouri's request to become a state. Talmadge proposed that no more slaves be brought into Missouri and that the children of slaves already there be freed at the age of 25. His proposal started a debate that lasted a year. Supporters of Talmadge argued that his proposed amendment was constitutional. The Constitution, they said, gave Congress the right to admit new states into the Union. This also meant, they said, that Congress could refuse to admit new states unless these states met conditions demanded by Congress. Supporters of the amendment also said small farmers of the North and East could not compete with the Southern farmers and the free labor of slaves. They argued that these Northern and Eastern farmers had as much right to the land of Missouri as anyone else. The Louisiana Territory had been paid for by the taxes of all Americans. Those opposed to slavery also argued that slaveholding states would be given too great a voice in the government if Missouri joined them. Under the Constitution, only 3 out of every 5 slaves were counted in the national population. The census, taken every 10 years, is used to set the number of members for each state in the House of Representatives. In the House, unlike the Senate, the number of votes that a state has is based on its population. In the past, each time a slave state was admitted to the Union, a free state had also been admitted. Harlow Giles Unger explains what the supporters of the amendment may have been thinking.
The problem basically was not so much a moral problem from their point of view. It was much moral as it was economic, because the northern states could not compete with southern states. Northern states paid their labor by the piece. The South, slave labor was free of charge. So the South had a tremendous economic advantage. They could produce goods at much lower cost than the North. And the advent of a majority in the Senate would have tilted the balance of power.
Southerners had an answer for each argument of those supporting the Talmadge Amendment. They agreed that Congress had the constitutional right to admit or reject a state. But they said Congress did not have the right to make conditions for a territory to become a state. William Pinckney of Maryland argued that states already in the Union had joined without any conditions. If Congress, he declared, had the right to set conditions for new states, then these new states would not be equal to the old ones. The United States would no longer be a union of equal states. The debate was intense on both sides. The House of Representatives passed the Missouri bill with the Talmadge Amendment, but the Senate rejected it. The people of Missouri would try again for statehood when the new Congress met in 1820. By this time, another free state was ready to enter the Union. Maine, with the permission of Massachusetts, asked to become a separate state. The Senate joined the Maine bill with the one for unconditional statehood for Missouri. Senators refused to separate the two, and so they continued to debate about conditions for statehood and slavery. Finally, Senator Jesse Thomas of Illinois offered a compromise. He said Maine could be admitted as a free state and Missouri as a state permitting slavery. But he said that no other state allowing slavery could be formed from the northern part of the Louisiana Territory. Many Southerners were not satisfied. The compromise closed the door against slavery entering large new areas of land. Southerners, like any other Americans, had a right to settle in the new territory. The Senate accepted Thomas's compromise. Congress approved statehood for both Missouri and Maine. Now, President Monroe just needed to sign the bills. It was the spring of 1820. James Monroe was coming to the end of his first 4 years as president. He wanted to be elected again, but he faced a difficult decision about whether to allow the Missouri Compromise. President Monroe owned slaves. He understood the feelings of the South. His friends urged him to veto the compromise bill because it limited slavery in the territory. He also understood the strong feelings of those who opposed slavery. Monroe believed the compromise was wrong, but not because it kept slaves out of the territory. The president did not believe the Constitution gave Congress the right to make such conditions. Monroe even wrote a veto message explaining why he could not approve the compromise, but in the end, he did not use his veto. He believed there might be civil war if he rejected the compromise. So Monroe signed the bill. Missouri had permission to enter the Union as a slave state. The crisis seemed to end, but a few months later, a new problem developed. Missouri wrote a state constitution that it sent to Congress for approval. One part of this constitution did not permit free black men to enter the state. A number of lawmakers in Congress immediately opposed the state constitution. They said it violated the United States Constitution. The United States Constitution said citizens of each state had the same rights as citizens of each of the other states. And since free black men were citizens of some states, they should have the right to be citizens of Missouri. The debate lasted several months. Former House Speaker Henry Clay finally proposed a compromise that both sides accepted. Missouri could become a state if its legislature would make this promise. It would never pass any law that would violate the rights of any citizen of another state. This second compromise ended the dispute over slavery in Missouri and the Louisiana Territory. The Compromise Actions of 1820 settled the crisis of slavery for more than 20 years. But everyone knew that the settlement was only temporary. Former President Thomas Jefferson expressed his feelings with these words: "This momentous question, like a fire bell in the night, awakened and filled me with terror. I considered it at once as the knell of the Union. It is hushed, indeed, for the moment. But this is a reprieve only," he said, "not a final sentence."
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.